You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a Milwaukee native who created a podcast focusing on the lives and stories of drummers.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Yesterday, the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office charged a former Milwaukee police officer with reckless homicide after he had shot and killed a man after a traffic stop back in August. The shooting sparked days of unrest in the city.
Robert Menser is with us again for the details of this and other top stories from the past week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and he joins us every Friday. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, thank you.
Well, Rob, can you refresh our memories? What happened that led to this shooting back in August?
So this was a case where the former Milwaukee police officer, Dominique Keegan Brown, was patrolling with his partner. They saw activity they say is consistent with drug activity and started chasing a guy. Sylville Smith had a handgun. He was running away from the police. He was 23 years old. He slipped and fell and then got up trying to throw his gun away, throw it over a fence into someone's yard. And prosecutors say that is when Keegan Brown shot Smith twice, once in the shoulder as Smith was raising his arm to throw the gun, and then again in the chest after that, which killed Smith. And it's the second shot, according to prosecutors, that was illegal because Smith was unarmed at the time that the second shot was taken.
And there's body cam footage of what you're describing, right?
Right. This is the primary source for the criminal complaint is body cam footage from Keegan Brown. Now that has not been made public, but it is described in some detail in that complaint, and theoretically it should be a public document. I assume that at some point it will be seen by the public.
Now, these charges, this happened in August, and these charges are just happening now. Is the investigation has just taken this long to get to this point?
Yes, this is unusual for sure, and it seems to be related to a very tangled second case against Keegan Brown. I characterize him as a former Milwaukee police officer. That's because in October he was charged with three felonies and two misdemeanors in a sexual assault and prostitution case. He's charged with raping an intoxicated man the day after he shot Smith. In that case, it said that he was in a bar bragging that he can, the quote is, do whatever he wanted without repercussions as they were watching, unrest and rioting in the Sherman Park neighborhood. That case is a separate case that is not mentioned in this homicide case, but in the investigation, the state attorney general did say that sort of investigating those two, seeing if there was a connection between the shooting itself and this relating to this sexual assault case, that does not seem to be the case. They seem to be separate incidents, but certainly that complicates matters and complicated and lengthened the investigation.
So, Robert, what's next with this?
Well, if convicted, Keegan Brown will face up to 40 years on this charge. Of course, it's rare enough that a police officer is charged with homicide for a shooting, an on-duty shooting. That in itself is rare. It's also, as we've seen in cases around the country, it's quite rare for a police officer to be convicted. So, presumably this will go to trial. It is going to be, I think, the defense lawyers already signaled in their initial responses that a large part of their the defense against against the charges are going to be this contention that the first shot that Keegan Brown took was legal, the second shot was illegal, and they were only separated by less than 2 seconds. So they will make that case to the jury. We will see what the outcome of that trial is, and then of course this other on a separate track, this other sexual assault trial.
We're talking with Rob Menser from USA Today Network Wisconsin, getting caught up on the latest in-state news. And another top story wrap up this week, a judge serving as a Democratic member of the Wisconsin Ethics Commission resigned. What happened?
Yes, Robert Kinney is a former Oneida County judge. He's from Rhinelander, and he's now a reserve judge, which is basically a retired judge who sometimes can fill in. He was one of the members of the state's ethics commission, and he quit. He said that it's because he said in a statement that that the commission did not take action on a complaint that was brought in a private session, and so he doesn't want to serve on the commission anymore. He didn't say what the complaint actually was or who was involved, but the statement that he did release refers to allegations of quid pro quo corruption, and we do know this was Jason Stein of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported this, that in October Democrats had filed an ethics complaint against the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee because they, the Republicans, had not submitted a report on fundraising for September. If you recall, there was this election thing that was coming up at that time, so it was the sort of information that you would want to have the public know about, or one might. So Kinney referred to a complaint that was not brought forward, as well as some other issues on the commission.
And Kinney was one of six on the panel. What happens now? There's this vacancy.
Yeah, so they will replace the vacancy. The chairman of the commission will issued a terse statement and said that they'll replace Kinney. The issue really, what this really calls attention to is this, you know, this is a new board, right? The Ethics Commission itself hasn't existed for long. It is the result of Governor Scott Walker and legislative Republicans' decision to dissolve the state's Government Accountability Board. They split that into an Elections Commission and an Ethics Commission, two separate agencies, and mostly the view is that splitting it makes both of the two agencies less powerful than as a watchdog than the Government Accountability Board would have been. So this definitely is part of that fight, which is highly partisan. Democrats and Republicans tend to have a different view about this, and it certainly spotlights that disagreement.
And then finally, Rob, earlier this week, Representative Joel Clayfish announced that he's going to draft a bill requiring high schoolers who are doing extracurricular activities, things like sports, to be randomly drug tested. Why does he want to do that?
Yes, so this is a proposal of Republican Representative Joel Clayfish of Oconomowoc. He is certainly a lawmaker who likes to make headlines and make waves. So this is just all this is a proposal. He says he's going to introduce a bill. We don't have the bill, let alone do we have, you know, signals about whether this bill is likely to pass. But yeah, it's the sort of thing that I think everyone sort of has an opinion about. You have a feeling about it when you first hear about it. The purpose of it, the stated purpose, is it's an anti-drug bill, right? It's meant to try to counter the heroin epidemic, the fact that that there are kids using drugs in schools, and so, you know, the idea is that drug testing, if you're involved in any extracurricular activity, it could be a punishment that might deter students from using drugs. Whether it actually works in practice is a bit of another question.
And so what kind of reaction has this bill gotten? I mean, it hasn't really, it's really just not been introduced, but what do we know about what people think?
Yeah, so, you know, there are a small handful, three or four districts around the state that have a policy similar to this. And in general, what people say, what has been observed about these policies is that they're quite expensive, so they're a burden on districts, and they don't really catch that many people. They're random drug testing, they're suspicionless drug testing, and so you end up spending a lot of money for not maybe a lot of results, let alone, you know, the other response from critics of this policy is it doesn't address then any sort of programming, getting kids help if they need help, if there are, in fact, addiction issues, sort of what then after you kick them off the football team or whatever. So I think there's a lot of questions around the funding and around the sort of philosophy, but it's certainly an interesting proposal, and maybe we'll be hearing more about it next year.
Rob, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
That was Robert Menzer, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He's with us every Friday to talk about the week's top news. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Facebook announced plans to combat fake news yesterday. Find out why the new move is stirring up some controversy.
But first, what do you call a person who hangs out with musicians? A drummer.
Yeah. There's nobody to do a rim shot for that
one. I know. It kind of fell flat.
Because the drummers just, they boycott that.
That's why we need drummers. Well, you know, joking aside, how many famous drummers can you name other than Ringo?
Well, I can name a bunch, but our next guest can name a lot more. He tracks down and interviews his favorite drummers for his own podcast. Joe Wong joins us now. He's the host and producer of The Trap Set. It's a podcast that delves into the lives of drummers. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you grew up in Milwaukee, as I understand it. Joe, how did you first get into drumming?
I was 11 years old, and for some reason, I decided to take drum lessons with a guy that lived a couple blocks away from me named John Ruka, and he actually taught lots of the drummers that came out of Milwaukee in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I had previously played piano and clarinet and violin, but the drum set was what really felt like a vehicle for me as far as meeting other musicians and getting into bands and playing rock music at the time.
Now, having been in bands, I know there are drummer jokes like the one we started off with. There are also saxophonist jokes, I guess, that people target me with. But do you think that drummers get
What's
the attention?
What's a saxophone joke?
Of course, none popped in my mind having said that. But do you think drummers don't get the respect they deserve?
Probably not. Lots of the time, by design, drummers are in the background. They're kind of the foundation of whatever musical group they're playing in. So they're not the people who the majority of the accolades are heaved upon, usually.
And you just completed your 100th episode of The Trap Set. How did you get started with this? You're interviewing drummers, a lot of famous drummers, actually. How did you get that rolling?
Well, I'm a neurotic person by nature, and I wanted to work through my neuroses with other people that had been successful or unsuccessful in the same line of work as myself. So basically, it was an excuse to figure out how other people navigate through life. And just the fact that both of my guests and myself are drummers is almost incidental, but it allows us a certain familiarity from which we can delve into deeper issues right away.
Well, listen to some of the drumming of these drummers in a bit, but you've interviewed some legendary drummers, some of them, I'm guessing, heroes of yours. Are there any anecdotes or stories that stand out to you?
One of the drummers that I thought, if I could ever meet this guy face to face, it would be incredible, was Bernard Purdy. And Bernard was one of the top studio drummers in New York, especially in the 60s and 70s. He played with everyone from Aretha Franklin to Steely Dan to Nina Simone. And he's quite a character. And he's always on in his public performances, but when I showed up to interview him, he had forgotten that we had it set up, and he answered the door in his bathrobe. I think I had woken him up. but we got into a really deep interview about his life and his family and his childhood and his career. And then once in a while, I would just be looking across the room and see this face that I'd watched on YouTube a million times, and it felt very surreal.
Well, here is Purdy playing the song Funky Donkey. You'd send us a list of clips, suggestions. Here's a listen to that. Get it! All right, the drumming go there a little bit. Do you talk technique and the finer points of drumming much, or is it mostly more about kind of the story behind their lives and their music?
It's really the story behind their lives and their music. There are plenty of kind of sources that discuss technique, but our goal when we set out to make this show would be to find the kind of universal appeal in these people's live stories. So that's why my co-producer of the show, who's actually a former Madison resident, Chris Karwowski, came on board. And Chris is not a professional musician. He's actually a comedy writer who wrote for The Onion for 12 years and Adult Swim and stuff like that. And he's really good at kind of picking out the stories that resonate with a larger audience than just drummers or musicians.
So what kind of stories did you hear from Purdy in that deep conversation?
Well, he told me about how his father was killed by his best friend over like a gambling disagreement, and then his father's best friend disappeared and probably killed himself. And how he couldn't afford to take drum lessons when he was a young kid, so he would just sit outside the man who taught lots of the drummers in his area and just listen to other kids getting drum lessons. And that's how he kind of got started. And then he told me about how he went to New York and, you know, after being there for a few years, was so successful that he basically had drum kits stored in all of the major studios and would just go from session to session. And then that system has been outmoded. So he kind of walked me through, you know, how he navigated through the leaner times of the 80s and kind of how his career experienced a resurgence when artists such as Beck started sampling him and then eventually using him on records.
Yeah, that sampling issue for drummers, that's a big one here. And we have, of course, Clyde Stubblefield, who's been on the show, a lot of involvement with WPR. I've heard he's the most heavily sampled drummer ever, mainly from his work with James Brown. And he is not always happy about that. He hasn't always received the acclaim, the respect, and the money. Are drummers, in some cases at least, getting money for their samples?
I think now people are compelled to pay for samples, but usually the drummer doesn't get a piece of that unless the drummer has songwriting credit on the songs. There's a stark contrast between who's getting money and who's not. For example, there's one day that I was in Tennessee, and in the morning I interviewed Howard Grimes, who played on all the great High Records label releases, including all the iconic Al Green songs. Then in the afternoon, I spoke to Fluke Holland, who played with Johnny Cash and also with Carl Perkins, especially on like the Blue Suede Shoes session. And, you know, Howard was getting paid just like a session fee, probably under $100 per session at that time, whereas Fluke got cut in on the songwriting for songs like Blue Suede Shoes and the difference between the income that those guys are receiving now is insane.
I'm talking to Joe Wong. He is host and producer of The Trap Set. It's a podcast about the lives of drummers, 100 episodes in now. Here's another listen to a legendary drummer you got to interview. The track is a Grace Jones track. We'll talk about the drummer in just a minute. And that's Sly Dunbar, half of Sly and Robbie, this amazing, legendary reggae and dub and everything else rhythm section. And you got to interview Sly Dunbar, which is pretty amazing. What did you take out of that conversation?
Well, I was really inspired by his attitude. Sly is another of the most recorded drummers in the world. It's been estimated that he's been used on something like 10,000 recordings. Ranging from, you know, Jamaican legends such as Lee Perry to international stars like Bob Dylan and Serge Gainsbourg. And he still goes to the studio every day and probably works 80 hours a week And he's somebody who's made a good living, but he just keeps going because that's what he loves to do. And that's the thing that I took away most is his, like, inexhaustible work ethic.
Yeah, there's a wide range of work ethics out there. Have you ever interviewed Ginger Baker? He's had some famously difficult interviews over the years, and he has said, "Yeah, I don't practice. I never have practiced regularly."
Yeah, lots of great artists don't practice in the traditional sense, but you know, somebody like Ginger, I'm sure he practiced at some point, and he put in his 10,000 hours.
Right.
If you want to get Gladwellian about it, so. I feel like somebody like Sly Dunbar, his work ethic comes from a place of joy. And then other people, you know, might not have had such a happy childhood, or they have some sort of chip on their shoulder. And that's why they get so great is through, you know, this inexhaustible drive to prove themselves to somebody or some part of themselves.
I want to give a quick listen to one more track, a very different one here. This is the band Slayer. This is an isolated drum and bass track from the song Angel of Death. And just metal and speed going there. And that just, the few tracks we played, the incredible variety of approaches to drumming. And it sounds like a variety of approaches to living and being a musician and all the drummers you've talked to, Joe.
That's right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Dave Lombardo is really interesting because he came from Cuba. His family were Cuban immigrants, and they kind of were able to smuggle their kids into the United States through the Catholic Church right around the time of the Revolution. And they came over here. His dad moved the family to Los Angeles and became a butcher inside of a grocery store, never learned a word of English. And Dave credits his Cuban upbringing to his incredibly dense rhythmic style, which
Wow.
you can hear in his playing. I mean, it's very, very fast and dense. And I think that it has more in common with folks like Tito Puente than it does with, you know, his other metal contemporaries.
Well, Joe, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll point people toward the Trap set for a lot more stories. And Joe, thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks. Did you think of a saxophone joke yet?
My co-host had one about a chicken that's been run over in the road. The difference between that and a saxophone is the chicken may have been on its way to a gig. So there you go.
Okay.
A saxophone joke. Thanks to Joe Wong, host and producer of The Trap Set, a podcast that looks at the lives of drummers. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, a look at the new Secretary of State nominee, a conservative viewpoint on Donald Trump, and the career of the late Senator John Glenn. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, a Pew Research Center survey showed that 1 in 4 Americans have shared a fake news story. That includes people who knowingly shared a fake political news story and those who didn't know the story was made up until after they had posted it. Yesterday, Facebook announced a new effort to prevent that from happening by fact-checking stories.
Fake news shared on Facebook got attention in the days after the election amid concern that the fabricated stories might have helped sway the election results. At the time, Facebook chairman and chief executive Mark Zuckerberg dismissed the idea that the platform had affected the election outcome.
Katie Culver joins us now. She's the director of the Center for Journalism Ethics and assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Katie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, from what you've seen and what Facebook is doing here, what's the plan? How are they going to try to determine fakes, and what are they going to do about it?
Well, it's a multi-part plan. So they're going to invite users to begin flagging things as stories that aren't true, that are completely fake. And then after people flag a story, there's going to be an algorithm that intervenes, and the algorithm will do its best to try to determine whether this is actually a case that should be investigated. And then it'll go to a network of human fact-checkers. So they're relying on an existing network of people who have agreed to a set of principles about fact-checking. And that's a really important element. Once those fact-checkers determine something as debunked and they are required to cite sources in that debunking, then the posts will be flagged on Facebook in red, and you won't be able to share them until you acknowledge that this is a disputed story that may well be fake.
And who are they going to? They've got some partners in already existing media and fact-checking operations, right?
Right. So places like factcheck.org, these are all organized through the Poynter Center, which is through the Poynter Institute, which is a center for media studies based in St. Petersburg, Florida. It does quite a bit of work with journalism training and journalism ethics.
So Facebook is in a weird position, and this tension's been there all along. They say, we're not a media outlet, but a growing percentage of people rely on Facebook as their source of shared news. So as you see it, looking at this from the perspective of journalism ethics, what, if any, responsibility does Facebook have when it comes to fake news transmitted on their sites?
So Mark Zuckerberg is right. They're not a news media outlet, but they are a tremendously powerful platform with, 1.7, 1.8 billion users. As a platform distributing fake news, they have incredible reach, incredible power. So I wouldn't argue that this is a case about journalism ethics for Facebook, but I would say it's a case of corporate social responsibility, of recognizing what their power is and what they need to do to ensure that that power does not damage citizens in a democracy.
And I want to define our terms a little bit and narrow in on what fake news is, because people are calling just about everything fake news over the last couple of weeks. But usually when we're saying fake news, it's some person, some guy somewhere completely making up a story, posting it out there, and it's shared often by people who ideologically want that story to be true, right? It's not all of the sort of vague or partisan stories that we're talking about here.
Right. I think what Facebook is trying to eliminate are the just patently false stories, stories that are clearly debunkable. They're not trying to be the arbiters of truth on things that are debatable. So, yes, if I'm a liberal partisan, I may want to say that anything that is unfavorable to Hillary Clinton is fake, that's false, it's wrong. That's not what Facebook is going after here. Facebook is going after stories like Michelle Obama was born a man, the Post has endorsed Donald Trump, these stories that are demonstrably, clearly fake. And I want to say that there are a couple of different reasons that people are putting these stories out there. Sometimes the incentive is purely financial. So it's people trying to put clickbait out, get it widely shared, and then they profit from it. But there are also people who are doing it for partisan reasons, to try to sway opinion. And both of those will be addressed by this Facebook plan.
Right. Facebook has also talked about trying to limit ad revenue for these completely fake news sites. Is that a big part of the solution, do you think?
I think that's a very big part of the solution. And not just limit their revenue, they're trying to gut that revenue. So it takes away this incentive for people to just throw things out there purely for their own personal gain.
Talking to Katie Culver, Assistant Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, talking about fake news and social media, a new effort from Facebook trying to limit, at least, the spread of fake news and, as she said, cut off the revenue stream for people making up fake news. Katie, I wonder about the power of fake news. I mean, it's always been with us. I used to be a big fan of the Weekly World News at the supermarket counter. The alien we would see on its cover met with all the presidential candidates, things like that. Is there something different about a fake news story when it's on a social media site where we go to see things about our friends and family? Does that give it legitimacy that the checkout aisle didn't?
It may give it legitimacy when it's shared by someone that we trust. So it's information that's coming to us from the friend, from the family member, and they're sharing fake news. And in fact, if you talk to people who have inadvertently shared something, and they sort of gasp that when you say to them in commenting that, well, this story has been debunked, and they say, oh, my gosh, well, I got that from my Aunt Cheryl, and she's trustworthy to me. It was unlikely that Aunt Cheryl would have been sharing the Weekly World News in all its crazy hoaxiness, but things are spreading more virally on these social media networks. So it's also the impact of the mere reach of it, how quickly we can share things and the tremendous number of people to whom they are shared. So, my aunt could say something to me, and that's a one-on-one conversation, but if my aunt posts it to Facebook, she has 500 followers, she's just got a much bigger reach.
now, in a way, we're all news editors, and what we decide to share and forward on to people, is media literacy of some sort part of the answer here, so we are better at sorting out the fake news stories?
I think media literacy is definitely important, but I also think having a public understanding of the ethical obligations of this, that, you know, I think the term "we're all journalists now" is a little bit too broad, but we all have obligations now that we all have access to these means to publish. We have obligations to think about the impact of the things that we do publish.
What would it take? I saw a quote in the USA Today where, they talk to ordinary social media users, and one woman saying, you know, I have kids, I work a full-time job, I'm not an investigative reporter, I don't have time to try to track down the authenticity of everything that pops up in my Facebook feed.
And that's the beauty of Facebook's approach here. And, you know, what it is finally doing with this plan is making it very easy for users to suss out something that has been demonstrated as false. So it's going to be flagged in red. You will be notified when you try to share something that it is disputed, that it is problematic. And so that makes things that much easier for the user. It's a little bit of, you know, building ethics into the engineering of the platform.
One type of response to this announcement from Facebook, a lot of conservative websites and bloggers say, oh, the liberal media is fact-checking this, casting doubts on the AP, PolitiFact, and the other fact-checking agencies that are going to be part of this, and saying they will be biased, they'll be more prone to dump conservative-leaning items than liberal-leaning ones. What do you make of that response?
Well, in some of the initial analysis, especially a very well-done look by BuzzFeed, we did find that there were fake news stories on both sides, on both left and right, but the right dominated. There were more fake news stories that were either pro-Trump or anti-Clinton than there were in the opposite direction. So yes, there may be more of these fake news stories that favor the right, but that doesn't make them any less fake. That said, I think Facebook has to be very careful about this because, you know, they were pressured earlier in the year. They were accused of anti-conservative bias in the human editors that were involved in their trending stories. And they largely removed those human editors and relied more on algorithms to determine that trending. And it resulted in fake news stories being more common among trending. So when you relied on things like shares or comments, you know, typical measures of engagement as indicating whether something was trending. Well, the top 10 fake news stories had higher engagement numbers than the top 10 real news stories about the election. So a human editor can suss that out. An algorithm cannot.
Katie Culver is with us now. She's director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. We're looking at Facebook and its plans to try to curb fake news, or at least slow the spread of fake news circulated on the social media giant.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about the announcement that Facebook is trying to slow the spread of fake news? And what do you think Facebook should do with fake news that it finds? What responsibility does Facebook or any other social media network have when it comes to weeding out fake news? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Katie Culver, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. We're looking at how Facebook is trying to combat the spread of fake news.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this Facebook effort? Do you support it? Are you optimistic that it will be able to make a dent in the spread of fake news? And are you worried that Facebook will privilege either the left or the right when it comes to how they enforce what they're trying to do to weed out fake news? Let us know at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Katie, before we go to our callers, we've seen numbers again and again over the last few years showing people lacking trust in journalism as a profession, as a service. A lot of obviously tumultuous times for journalism, changes for newspapers and other media over the years. Are there things that the media, and that's a big term, but the mainstream media can do to bring people home, to reestablish their identity as a trusted platform that maybe will crowd out the fake news?
So I think I think the news media are doing a lot to try to put out content that can be trusted. I think it's very, very difficult for news organizations and individual journalists when people use terms like the media, because we're equating the very good work that the Washington Post did in its election reporting on, for instance, the Clinton Foundation or the Trump Foundation, with something that says that the Pope has endorsed Donald Trump. So I think it's a difficult time in journalism because people feel like they're being blamed for things that are not necessarily anywhere near associated to the products that they're putting out. I also think it's a time for journalism to say, we need to think exactly how we're going to try to rebuild this trust, about how we're going to get people to value what we do. It's a tough nut to crack in this time when people seem to be very, very motivated to only find content that reinforces their own worldview. It's a difficult time.
Right. It almost seems like there's a sort of nihilism in some attitudes toward the media where a minor mistake that is corrected in an old-fashioned newspaper is leads people to treat it on the same level of unreliability as a completely made-up fake news site. Are we losing perspective as news consumers?
Yes, and I think the public has a responsibility here. Citizens have a responsibility to be consuming information that provides them facts placed within their proper context, and to be deliberating about that, that we are not just using fake news stories or other slanted coverage to reinforce our own viewpoints. We have to be deliberative. We have to be listening to each other again.
Let's go to our callers now. Michael is with us in Jackson. Michael, hi.
Good evening. How are you all today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I guess my question and comment is, that most consumers of the internet realize that it is essentially the wild, wild west, and the whole concept of fake news, while well-intentioned, perhaps should be put in the light of personal responsibility. And for those people who don't have the time, for whatever reason, to consume multiple sources on different platforms, that's all right. We're all busy people. However, for the nanny state to come in and to regulate and to monitor does one thing. It stifles speech. Whether it's something that people like to hear or not like to hear, one position or the other, it's irrelevant.
Well, Michael, this proposal is coming from Facebook itself. What do you think about that, them changing how they promote or not things that appear on their feeds?
Well, as a shareholder of that corporation, I don't want them to be censoring anything. That's not their business model.
Gotcha. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Katie, he's saying, it's the Wild West. Let's keep it that way. Surfer beware, I guess.
Well, I think part of the reason that Facebook has 1.7 to 1.8 billion users and that MySpace is dead is that Facebook is not the Wild West. And MySpace was the Wild West, and people left it in droves because of things like polluted information, some very heinous activities involving trolling for children. Facebook set up a platform that is good for users, so users can rely on that service, and it's also good for advertisers. And that's an interesting point that's lost here, is that, to say that Facebook should just tolerate fake news, should Facebook then just tolerate fake advertising? That, if 1% of the products that were advertised on Facebook were fraudulent, I think that Facebook would have an equal problem with that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Michael. We'll go next to Robert in Lake Geneva. Robert, hi.
Hi. I think it's a good idea. I like that Facebook is, I think this is a step in the right direction. I was wondering from your guest, what sort of things can we as people do to help identify these types of articles? What kind of tools can we use when we look at an article and say, hey, this might be legitimate, this might not be legitimate?
Interesting. Katie, what's out there?
That's a fantastic question, and I'm glad you brought it up because it's something that I should have mentioned earlier. In addition to what Facebook had on this week, Slate, the news organization, has created a plugin for a browser. It's currently only available for the Chrome browser, but that's a dominant browser. And you can install that plugin, and whenever you happen upon a disputed news story, something that has been debunked as false by a fact-checking organization like Snopes.com, it will highlight that within whatever feed you're in. So it goes beyond what Facebook is doing, which is only within the walled garden of Facebook, and it will do the same thing on Twitter and if you are, you know, reading something on someone's blog, for instance. So that relies on the power of crowds, but again, is vetted by Slate's own internal editorial team. So it's a great tool for users who would be very busy and as the other caller said, really don't necessarily have time to vet everything that they see online.
Robert, thanks for the call. We're talking about fake news, new efforts by Facebook to limit the spread of fake news, maybe indicate that something is fake. Katie Culver's with us from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Communication. We'll go to our callers again. Floyd is with us in Milwaukee. Floyd, hi.
Hi, Rob. My only comment is, why can't Facebook attach a link to where they found out it was false and let readers look for it themselves? If people are busy and don't have the time, this way it's there. They can read it and evaluate what they think.
Floyd, thanks for the call. And as I understand it, there's going to be some kind of indication, like these stories won't completely disappear, right, Katie? They'll be less, the algorithm will make them less likely to appear in our feeds, and they'll have some kind of indication that they've been researched and found to be fake. Do I have that right?
But yeah, and Floyd could be a platform engineer for Facebook because that is exactly what they're requiring. So this network of fact-checking organizations, when they go in and declare something as being debunked, that this is a fake news story, they have to provide the source or sources that demonstrate that. So they have to link to other information that will help people understand why this information is false. One of the outlets that's involved, Snopes.com, is my favorite go-to for this sort of debunking. I've been relying on them since back in the 1990s to help me understand what is and is not true online.
Yeah, that's been a useful tool for me working here at Public Radio, but also personally. I've seen stories from the left and right come up in emails and then on social media, and often you can tell from the language a lot of the time, but Snopes almost all the time has checked it out and debunked it very quickly. So that's there, and they must have expanded their operation, I'm assuming, given how much this stuff has really flourished.
Well, they actually still do it on quite the shoestring budget without a lot of people, but they really have it down to a science. And also, I want to make clear here that we've been talking about this largely in a, you know, politically motivated fake news context, and that's really not fair. You know, the latest kerfuffle is about whether this did or did not influence the election. But this fake news is not only about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. It's about things like vaccination and about economic concepts and about celebrities. So there's more than just the political sphere involved here.
Time for one more caller. Chris is with us in Columbus. Chris, hi.
Yeah, so I've been with a Facebook user for a while, and it's just the natural evolution of Facebook. They're always changing something to make the platform better, so it's not really a big deal. I will say, however, I am concerned because in, you know, popular press, I won't say mainstream media, in popular press, you know, Breitbart News has gotten this tag of platform for white nationalist news. And it gets regurgitated all over TV and the radio and internet, and that's just not true. If you're a regular consumer of Breitbart News and other news sources, you understand that it's just a different style of delivery, much like BuzzFeed is newstainment. And it's no more a white nationalist or, you know, something like that than National Review. Only National Review is more cerebral.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And yeah, that's maybe a difficult thing. Partisan-leaning websites on the left or right, Katie, will they get caught up maybe unfairly in the effort to crack down on fake news?
That's a really good question, or a really good point that's being made here. I mean, I think part of the reason that this alt-right label has been attached to Breitbart is that Steve Bannon said that that's where he was taking Breitbart when he took charge, when he took leadership of it. So that's part of the reason that label has been sticking. I would disagree with the caller that this is just another natural development in Facebook's evolution.
And we have to leave it there, out of time. Sorry to leave you not with much time for that answer. That's Katie Culver from the UW-Madison talking about Facebook's plans to fact-check stories to curb the spread of fake news.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.